Good morning.
Very good to be back. I've experienced this each time I've been on sabbatical. I've experienced that reality that we're not meant to be wandering, we're meant to be planted. And it's good to see other places and see what goes on, but actually it's fantastic to be back with your own family. Most of the time was sabbatical. I've done some really wonderful studies. Thank you for the time to do that. I gained a lot from that, and no doubt things will be coming out to the church as time goes on. One of the things we were able to do on sabbatical, we had a two-day, I have 2 days off a week rather than the normal one, which was quite nice. So we did various things together. Marion one day went off to Blenheim Palace, and the sun came out. It was so warm. And I was sitting there, and I thought, get some vitamin D, roll my sleeves up. And of course, I had long trousers on. I thought, if I was Dave Bentley, I would have shorts on. And then I heard this James being spoken. And I looked around, and there's Lynn and Dave. And Lynn was just saying to Dave, that looks like James. And there he was in his shorts. And then there was another hello, and it was Sarah Stevenson. And she recognized me from the back. She said, I was glad to see the back of you. She didn't, actually, but that was just well. Can I have an image? And but we also had some period of holiday time. We had 2 weeks of holiday rolled into that 9 weeks, and we went to Italy, had a week in Rome, and a week elsewhere. We discovered that many great things. So I've now discovered where Donald Trump gets his wigs from. And Rome's amazing. There's just ancient monuments everywhere. Marion found a new friend. I was just reflecting that the women in our family like big men, don't they, really? Marion has had to make do with me. Now she's found Neptune, I believe, or somebody similar to that. Of course, it's an inspiring place, and we're going to be talking about the cost of commitment. And this place, the Colosseum, is something we associate in our minds very much with Christians and martyrdom. Probably Christians weren't martyred there, actually. But it's nevertheless associated with that. One of the places which inspires me is the Pantheon, and a Pantheon means all... it's a temple to worship all gods. And that has been there since the time of the Romans. That's the only Roman temple which is standing and in good condition, and you can just use it. Amazing structure, but what really hit me standing there was that is now a church. That is now a church. And your forebears and my forebears in the faith, because of that truth, we see it in Revelations, that they overcame by the word of their testimony, and because they did not love their lives even unto death. And they completely transformed that Roman Empire with their testimony and with their bravery and with their owning of Jesus. And so that stands as that picture, that representation for me of that. Now, before I dive on into the passage for today, and it fits well with that, I want to just flag this again. I think, are you all aware of the Just Walk Across the Room program that's coming up? Yeah-ish. You all aware of it? No. We have, in June, we're going to be following this program, which is put together by Willow Creek, called Just Walk Across the Room. And it's a superb program to help us to share our faith in the context of just naturally walking across the room and engaging with people and talking with people. And I would like that everybody in the church does this. Now, everyone in the church is not in our small groups. The small groups will be following this program, some a bit later in the year, but many this term. I trust that we have a sign-up sheet outside in the hall. There should be one in the hall, in the lobby by now. If there isn't one, we'll have to put a bit of paper out there. But if you're not in a small group and would like to do this program, we would like to either fit you into groups or to start an extra group to accommodate you, because this is going to be a fabulous time together. There'll be 4 weeks of preaching in our services, and there are 4 weeks of this program in discussion groups, in small groups. You'll need to buy one of these. If you can't afford it, we'll happily give you one, and it's great if you can also get the book, so you can tick those off. But this is a good program. Trust in another week, when we're not quite so full, we can show a little video about that as well. But if you could get that signed up today, then please do, or come and ask some questions. Right, we're into Mark chapter 8, and verse 31 to 38 is what's set for the day today. And I want to start with the central drama of the passage. That dramatic line where Jesus turns around and he rebukes Peter. I want you just to get the image of what's happening here. Jesus is teaching his disciples. He's teaching them what's going to happen. He's teaching about his death. And Peter says, in his own mind, this is all wrong. I've got to put Jesus straight. And he puts his arm around Jesus and he takes Jesus away and quietly says to him, you know, this isn't going to happen, is what he basically says. In fact, Matthew's gospel spells it out. I haven't put it up on there, I'm sorry, but Matthew's gospel does spell it out. Matthew's gospel tells you that he actually says that it's not going to happen, he's not going to die. I think he must have thought that Jesus is on a real wobble, that Jesus is kind of heading off in this little trip to be Messiah, and suddenly the whole thing's overwhelming him and he thinks it's all going to finish. And Jesus got the wrong end of the stick, so Peter's going to put him right. And then it says that Jesus turned and looked. Now, those two words, I'm sorry, a bit of Greek here. I hope you don't feel that's taken away from the drama of the moment. A bit of Greek here, but it's important because they're participles. Greek is full of participles. And participles can serve as adjectives, they can add to a noun, or they can act as adverbs. And in this case, acting as an adverb. And it's an aorist. And that means that it's something that has a causal relationship. Either you can say, after this happened, or because of this happened. So there's something about this which is saying that Jesus, in turning and looking at the disciples, is then somehow caused to rebuke Peter. He turns around. He's just had this word from Peter. He turns around. He sees his disciples, and he says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." Extreme result. Now, what is it? What is it in that act of turning and looking that his disciples in some way caused Jesus to rebuke Peter? What is it in that act that somehow causes Jesus to rebuke Peter? And I want you to hold that one, because we come back to that at the end of our talk. What is it in turning and looking at the disciples that causes Jesus to rebuke Peter? What is it? I want to start off with just this Son of Man title. This I've called it Christ's alias. It's Christ's favorite term for himself. It's by far and away the most common term that Jesus uses to describe himself. This is his little alias, his riddle almost. And it caused confusion. If you look in John's Gospel, chapter 12, the people are complaining to Jesus because they don't understand it. Chapter 12, verse 34. The crowd spoke up. "We have heard from the Lord." We've heard from the law that the Christ will remain forever. So how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? And you can just see that there's a confusion there, because they're clearly using the word the Christ. So there's some kind of sense that Jesus is this Messiah figure. But they're not quite sure, because Jesus keeps on using this word Son of Man. He doesn't give it away who he is. There's a secrecy theme through the gospel. frequently you see Jesus telling people, don't tell everybody what's happened. In fact, it's here in this passage. If you turn back to the previous verses, there's that passage where Jesus talks to the disciples. So verse 27 of chapter 8 of Mark, Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, who do people say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others, one of the prophets. But what about you? He asked, who do you say I am? Peter answered, you are the Christ. Listen to the next line. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. And you find that secrecy theme running right through the Gospels, that Jesus doesn't want it to be known what he is exactly. In his trial, he makes it plain. And if you go to the end of Matthew there, Matthew chapter 26, verse 64, it says, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied, but I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. And there Jesus has identified exactly who he is. And if you just turn back to Daniel 7 and verse 13, you can see where this concept that Jesus is talking about in his trial is coming from. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. You see, in the Old Testament, Son of Man mostly refers simply to a man. You could read through Ezekiel. Ezekiel's constantly talking about God talking to him as Son of Man. Son of Man. That just means man. And those mysterious titles where you contrast the sons of God with the sons of man. So man is just you and me, Son of Man. But Jesus is taking this very specific title, Son of Man, as just this little secret code. And there at the trial, he says, this is what I mean by this code. I'm that one who's coming. I'm that one who's going to enter the presence of God and be glorified. I'm that one who will have dominion over the whole world. My use of the Son of Man means I'm the Messiah. I'm the Christ. I'm the one Israel's been waiting for. But I want it to be a secret right now through my life. That's what's happening. And the disciples had identified Jesus. They'd recognized that he was the Christ. And so, therefore, the time for plain teaching had come. And you see it in our text here, where it says... He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him to the side. So Jesus is speaking plainly to them because they now know who he is. This is a watershed. This is a watershed. The disciples have got to that point where they've articulated, Jesus, you are the Christ. How does Jesus respond? Right, now it's time for your next module. Here's what the Christ does. You've now learned I'm the Christ. Now let's learn what the Christ does. And here's the next module. He teaches them. And you can see, but for the crowd, they only get the principle in the next bit. After this, he calls the crowds to him, and they only get the principle of what it means. They don't get the fact that Jesus is the Christ. Okay, so that's the Son of Man. What about this must suffer? The way of Jesus, must, that word must. It's necessary that the Christ should suffer. It's a brain spinning new interpretation of the Christ. You know, they were expecting the Messiah to be, well, you know this, don't you? They were expecting to come and be the one who would drive out the Romans. He would come and establish Israel as the dominant nation, that all the nations of the world would be subject to Israel and would look to Israel and see in Israel that place where they can find God and find God's laws, and they'd be flocking to Israel and coming there. And it was very nationalistic, really. And that was the picture that they had. And you can understand why they had that picture. They were expecting this Messiah to solve their physical, earthly, material problems and do this for them. And then Jesus said, must. It's a necessary thing lying in the nature of the case. There's something Jesus is saying about the situation we're in, about the situation you're in. There's something which is necessary. I have to die. I have to suffer. And then I will rise. But this has to be. There's no other way. To fulfill prophecy, you know, in Isaiah 53, you've got those wonderful, wonderful words, haven't you, of what happened. Surely he took our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That it's prophesied that the Messiah will suffer. It's obedience to God. Later in the same passage, you see that it was God's will to crush him. But why? And, well, it's to get you and me out of a very, very deep hole. Just turn on a few chapters. Mark chapter 10, verse 45. Anyone know it, actually? The Son of Man did not come to serve, but to be served. And to give his life as a ransom for many. You know, a person who needs a ransom is in a hole. If you're taken by the pirates off Somalia and you're held captive and there's a ransom on your head, you're not going to go free unless the ransom is paid. You're in a hole. And you can do nothing about it. Somebody has to pay that money. Somebody has to pay that ransom if you're going to go free. Has to happen. Why are you giving these pirates money? Because there is no other way. That's the answer. Except some parties and governments will say, we'll not pay a ransom because it's for the bigger good. But if you want that person out, you have to pay the ransom. And Jesus, we're taught, had to die. Now this is an important message for us. Because, I don't know, there may be some here who haven't trusted Jesus. And the fact is that without Jesus, there is no way to peace with God. There is no way to put right that thing which keeps us separate from him. There's no way to deal with sin. There's no way to deal with the death we face and to give us the eternal life that we need. There's no other way. Jesus had to suffer, and he's died for you and for me. And the only waste in that is if we don't take it and say, Jesus, I'm going to take this, and I'm going to let this death for me give me that eternal life and that forgiveness. And I would ask you, if you haven't yet received Jesus, please do it. For Jesus, it was quite clear he must suffer. And you can see how radical this message is in Peter's response. Peter can't tolerate that response. This is not what the Messiah should do. Oh, yes, it is. But he didn't know it. And there's the echoes of the temptation of Christ in here, aren't there? The second or third temptation, depending whether you're reading Matthew or Luke's gospel. There's that narrative where the Satan comes to Jesus and says to Jesus in his temptations, if you will bow down and worship me, I will give you all the nations of the world. And here's the same thing. The temptation is there. Jesus, you don't have to die. Just become this big military leader and conquer the world. And when you do that, the kingdom will be here. And Jesus says, no, it won't. No, it won't. That will not bring the kingdom in. That will not bring the kingdom in. And there's a great danger in this point in the story, because the danger is that disciples now know who he is, and they must understand that they're not now to go out and raise an army to come behind Jesus. They must understand, now they know he's the Christ, they must understand that it's not about getting the swords ready, or in our day, the bombs ready. They must understand that it's a different way, it's a way of sacrifice. And for the crowd, they mustn't know, because they can't be taught this. You see it John chapter 6, don't you? In John chapter 6, where Jesus has fed the 5,000, what is it they want to do? They want to take him and make him king by force. They want their Messiah, who will set them free, and they want to take Jesus by force to be king and lead their army. The crowd mustn't know. The crowd mustn't know, because that's not the way. And the disciples must learn. So let me come into that part of the story where Jesus then calls the crowd and says, right now, I've talked to you disciples privately, now let's get the crowd together. And so there's that section in the back end of our passage here. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. Life and soul are the same word, psuche. So when you read that passage, if you want to do a Bible study about the significance of the difference between life and soul, just forget that study. It's the same word. It's something around the idea of the bearer of conscious experience. It's the life force. It's the thing that animates our bodies. Animals have it. It's not the human spirit. Animals have it. It's the thing that makes them alive and makes them conscious and makes them living and makes them. And you take that psuche away and they cease to be. It's the closest thing to it would be the heart. The heart is in the Old Testament, that center of personality, that center of will, that center of being, me. And we have to lose that life soul if we're going to save it. I have to lose me if I'm going to save me. I have to lose me if I'm going to save me. You have to lose your me if you're going to save you. That's what he's saying. If I live for me, I lose me. If I lose me to Jesus and the gospel, I save me. Now, please, it's Jesus and the gospel. It's the person and the word. It's interesting how twice that comes out in those verses there. You know, we can sometimes run away from the message, can't we, and say, oh, I love Jesus. It's Jesus and the gospel. It's the man and his word. And that brings us back in some ways to our story here, isn't it? You know, we need to share it, you know. Am I ashamed of, or do I announce Jesus? Am I ashamed of Jesus, or do I announce Jesus? This is the question. Am I ashamed of the gospel, or do I announce the gospel? That's what Jesus is saying. No, my cross isn't just any suffering which hits me through life. My cross that we're invited to take up is that thing that I carry in the cause of Christ, in the cause of his gospel. How many times do I shrink back from owning Jesus? How many times do I shrink back from sharing my faith in Jesus? Happens too often. Don't know about you. don't know what your context is and how much you're willing to take, pay that price, that way of suffering, you know, that way of giving of ourselves. And, you know, you go back to those early Christians, and I was just listening to a program to do with the studies, you know. It was an early Christian who saw the fact that those Romans would just put out children who were weak to die. They would just expose them, they called it, so that they would die. Little babies. They reckon that maybe out of a million girls born, maybe 300,000 would be exposed so they could have boys, not girls. And this Christian man, he started adopting them, started making a home for them, and he was martyred because of what he was doing. You know, there's people have done that kind of quality of good in our world. There's a situation when in the Roman times when plague hit and people were throwing out their dead. But along with the dead, they were throwing out the living who had the bug as well. And the Christians went up and collected up the living who had the plague. And that really challenged me. I thought, what is the quality of my love? What is the quality of my cry? Would I be willing to make that sacrifice that says, even though this will cost me my life, I will take that child in? I didn't find an easy answer in my heart. Even though there's no medical treatment, I will take and handle this body of a man who's diseased. And I might get that disease myself. It's no wonder that the early church won the hearts and minds and saw people come to faith, because what they saw was that Christ-likeness of love. That's what they saw. And I look at my pathetic life in some ways. I think, what do people see? What do they hear the message of Jesus from me regularly? So what did turning and seeing do to Jesus? Well, I think it did two things. One was, as he turns around and looks at his disciples, he thinks, every single one of you is without hope unless I go to the cross. And that spoke to me. I thought, when I look at my neighbors, the people I talk to day by day, I look at them and we have a joke together, or we do some work together, or we share something, or we just pass the time of day. As I look at them, do I think without them knowing Jesus, they're lost? Unless they know this, they're lost. What about my embarrassment? That's a small cost. What about my time? It's a small cost. Jesus looks at his disciples and when he looks at them, if I do not go to the cross, none of these men here and the women amongst the disciples, none of these would be in glory. I must go to the cross. I must go to the cross. And I believe the second thing that he sees there is this is a crucial moment for teaching. Peter is clearly putting me straight that actually this talk of sacrifice is not the way. And I need to make it very clear to my disciples, the way of sacrifice is the only way. This is the Christian way. We've got to go that way. The kingdom is built by love and sacrifice. You can't build the kingdom. You can't build the kingdom by evil. We build the kingdom by love and sacrifice, and that's the cost. And this has spoken to me this week. This passage is one of the problems with preaching is you get very close to these passages, and it has a way of making you uncomfortable. I trust, brothers and sisters, that I will, and for those here who it applies to as well, we become more bold in our speaking for Jesus, not being ashamed of him. And I trust that we'll also be more bold in being willing not to demand our rights, but to make those sacrifices that speak of Jesus and that way of love. Amen.